Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, renewing the packaging. A leading figure in the Catholic media world talks about the challenges of communicating the gospel message in today's digital society and says whilst the message is perennial, its packaging needs to be constantly revamped. A feast of green. As we prepare to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, we look back at the figure of Ireland's patron saint and examine why his feast day has become such a global festival. And the breath of God. Listen to a Lenten reflection from a Scottish Jesuit priest that takes as its inspiration the biblical passage where God breathed into man a breath of life and explores how we can breathe out the life of God for others during this season. How should we use the new media's language and communication methods for evangelizing in today's fast-paced digital society? This was the challenge being discussed at the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, held earlier this month. Among the participants at the meeting in the Vatican was Father Thomas Rosica, head of the Salt and Light Catholic Media Foundation and Television Network. He says whilst the gospel message itself is eternal, its packaging needs to be constantly revamped.
I don't think it's the message that has to be changed. You know, I still go back to John the 23rd's words when he opened the Second Vatican Council. The deposit of the faith remains. It's the packaging that has to be redone or rethought. And I think that's the constant challenge for us, especially those who work with young adults and young people. We look at the content of the church, the content of the church teaching, the deposit of faith. We recognize its perennial beauty, and we find constant new ways to retell that story. And so one of my challenges I have before me, I'm in charge of the Catholic Television Network in Canada, Salt and Light Television, which is fundamentally a biblical-based television network for an entire country. And we're telling the old story in new ways every day and making that story appealing, making that story understandable, making that story palatable. And when we do that, through all kinds of modern media and technology, the message is transmitted, the message is passed on, and you make it exciting and let people accept it, especially the younger generations. So that's the constant challenge before us. It's not just reiterating or retelling the same old story with the same words, but being creative. And that's what Jesus was. He was extremely creative in telling the story. He never spoke above people's heads. He spoke to them where they were.
Now, you said about telling it and putting the new packaging on it. Can you give us briefly an example of how you've done that, how you've maybe used some of the new technology but are telling the story in a way, that, as you say, that is more palatable?
Sure. We just had a recent thing in Canada, which I'm very proud of, and I know the bishops of Canada are extremely proud of. The Bishops' Conference decided 2 years ago to publish or to issue a pastoral letter on chastity for young adults. Now, at first glance, you say, who's going to read it? How are you ever going to get this message across? It isn't just a matter of, you know, repeating stories and saying the big no to all of these things, but it's to follow Pope Benedict's line and that Christianity and the Catholic Church is a big yes. And so we worked with the Bishops' Conference in the formulation of a beautiful pastoral letter, concluding it with the examples of some young saints and their own struggles with chastity and how they were chaste men and women. And then we not only published the letter in print, but we did it through television and through YouTube, and having young people talk about the letter and recite the letter in programs about it, and it spread like wildfire. And there's a lot more young people in Canada, and I'm told far beyond, that are speaking about chastity than would have spoken about chastity had they not had this new way where it's done on Twitter, it's done on YouTube, it's done through all kinds of different new techniques and new technology today. And I think the more and more we can incorporate multi-platform to get the message across, the more success we will have in transmitting the ancient story in new ways.
Now, one of the questions that Pope Benedict mentioned in his speech to the council was that as Catholic communicators, we need to ask this question. What challenges does the digital mindset pose to the faith and theology? And what are the effects of people's almost constant contact with computers and mobile devices? Are we becoming too dependent on them?
Those are very good questions. You know, there's extraordinary horizons with all of this, and there's tremendous limitations. A couple points I just respond to, that we have to be very careful in the church, and not only in the church, in other places, that we don't spin ourselves into irrelevance. You know, it's not the machine that's going to save the person, it's people to people. And we must never substitute human contact with machines, with iPhones, with iPads, with Twitter, with email, with texting. Nothing replaces the wonderful experience of being with another human being. And one of the fears I have, and it's been confirmed several times, is while we encourage young people to be on Facebook and to be on all of those other wonderful apparatus, we have to be careful that they don't forget that we have to deal with one another as persons. You can say things to persons in the flesh that you can't say on email. At the same time, you have to be careful that email and Twitter and texting is not the same as being with a person. The second thing I think is very important, when we send things on those electronic means, it's sometimes done without thought and without reflection. The whole pause, the necessary critical reflection, is often absent. And so we have to be aware of the great success of linking us together and forming this great global village, but at the same time, we have to be aware of the limitations. I always go back to the beginning story. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have beheld his glory. The Word did not become an email, an SMS, a text message, or some kind of a distant phenomenon being related to us through Twitter. The Word pitched his tent among us in the form of a baby. It was a human being. And I think the more incarnational our communication will be, these new forms of communication, the more effective it will be.
Coming to the question of metaphors, Jesus used the parables, and obviously there were the symbols like the sheep and the fields. But what would you, if you were pitching a program for young people, what metaphors would you be using?
I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, in my first life, in my real life, I'm a scripture teacher, so I study the sacred scriptures, and I've always marveled at Jesus's parables, where he incorporated everything around him into his teaching. He lived in a very agrarian culture. He worked along the sea, so you have fishing boats and nets and fish and sheep and fields and corn and everything else. And that really shows that he was attentive to his surroundings and the surroundings of the people. Nowadays, when we have to communicate the message of the church and teach and preach, we have to take into account where those people are at. So the homily that I give in a downtown big city surrounded by apartment buildings and skyscrapers and whatever is not the same as the homily I will give in the provinces or the prairies of Canada, where we're surrounded by great grain fields and whatever. So the first thing is we take into account where people are at and what makes up their culture. Secondly, what is the vocabulary that the people are using? For me to come in and to show off because I know biblical vocabulary and fancy theological languages means nothing. Unless I respect the people, I respect their vocabulary, their language, what is their lexicon? What are the images that people are familiar with? And then to take the gospel message and do that double task of interpretation. There's the whole science or the art of hermeneutics, which is very important in dealing with the teaching of the faith. How do we get across the symbols, the signs, the meaning in very simple terms? That was the other great thing of Jesus' teaching. He taught very complex things in such simple way. And that's also one of the great hallmarks of Pope Benedict XVI. His homilies, his text, The Light of the World, the book that's just about to come out on Jesus of Nazareth, profoundly moving, deep texts, because he's able to take very difficult concepts at times and make them understandable. And that's the mark of a great teacher.
Do you think also, I mean, using real-life examples is one of the most effective ways of, shall we say, reaching the hearts and minds of people?
Oh, absolutely. To talk about what's happening in the world today, to talk about things that are affecting people's lives, and to bring in those examples, always to illustrate the central point of the scriptures and not the other way around. I think sometimes that's where we get into trouble, that we want to talk about our personal feelings, our personal issues, or to start off with extraneous things. We always have to have in mind, what is the message I'm talking about? What's this parable dealing with? What did Jesus mean in this parable in his time? And what are the relevant links to that parable in our time? And to make that bridge, the hermeneutical gap, to cross that gap, to bridge it, and then to transmit the message.
Now, coming back to the language used by the church, I mean, there have been moves to consider simplifying some of the language. As I said, you know, using words like magisterium or something, a lot of people are going to not know what it means. Their eyes are going to glaze over in boredom if a speech is going to be littered with a lot of words like that.
You're correct. We do have a problem with vocabulary. But it's a responsibility of the teacher and the preacher and the priest or the deacon or the pastoral minister, or layperson or ordained, to always be aware of what the original word meant and then to find ways of communicating that in new ways without doing destruction or without disrespecting what the original word means. I think a lot of this is common sense and the passion of the preacher to want to get across the message. I will use any means possible to get across this message. And sometimes that means not using all of the big words, but knowing what those big words mean ourselves. Because if we don't know ourselves, then we're not communicating the right thing. And that's really the responsibility we have nowadays. Church language, church documents, all of our noble efforts at times could be vitiated or simply disregarded because nobody could understand them. And that's been one of our challenges for a long time, and we're trying to overcome that.
And when it comes to the digital culture, what do you think are the most serious challenges that it poses to our ability to speak and listen to the language? Something that speaks about the transcendence.
Rapidity, first of all. You know, there has to be this urge, an immediate response, which removes critical reflection. Number two, the digital culture separates us. It doesn't necessarily unite us. And we must always be conscious of the dignity of the human person and what it means to be with another human being. Sometimes the digital culture works against that. And the third thing with the digital culture, we must not spin ourselves into irrelevance. I have to buy the latest model of the iPad, the latest model of the iPhone, the newest BlackBerry, the newest thing. And it becomes a big race that what I just bought yesterday is already obsolete. I think that's a great danger. And the fourth thing I think we have to be aware of with the whole digital culture is, especially in terms of social networking. I mean, the movie was this big hit. I watched the movie Social Networking and came away from it shaking, shocked, frustrated, frightened. I said, this is what it's doing? Is this a good thing? I'm glad it didn't win the Academy Awards, I can assure you. We have to be aware that these kind of phenomenon with social networking, what is it doing to us? Is the question. I mean, it's one thing that I'm linked together with all my high school classmates or friends from 30 years ago and whatever, but what is it really doing to us? And what is it saying about the world? And what is it saying about our relationships with people? Is it really communicating and linking people together? When it's used at its best, it can do that. But when it's used at its worst, it can bring about just the opposite of what we would like it to do.
I was speaking to Father Thomas Rozica, Chief Executive Officer of the Salt and Light Television Network in Canada.
Oh, Paddy dear, and did you hear the news that's going round? Shamrock is forbid by law to grow on Irish ground.
From shepherd slave boy to missionary bishop who brought Christianity to the pagan Irish in the 5th century. This Thursday sees the feast day of St. Patrick, Ireland's much-loved patron saint. But what is the special appeal of St. Patrick? And why has his name day become such a global festival and feast of green?
Oh, the wearing of the green, the wearing of the green.
To find out more, I spoke to Father Matthew Gamba, a Jesuit priest of Irish descent who comes from the US city of Chicago, where a big parade is held every year on St. Patrick's Day and the city's river is dyed green. Father Matthew begins by paying tribute to St. Patrick's dedication and skill in carrying out his dangerous mission to Christianize the Irish during the 5th century.
Christ to win me, Christ to guide me on.
I think he really built on, you know, the desire for the divine among the people, that they did have a sense of ritual and some practice and a sense of searching and longing. But he really felt he had the good news of Jesus Christ in the Gospels and put that out there and met with great success. And I think he also worked with the leadership and thought if he can bring the leaders of the clans and the society to Christ, everyone else will also take note and come with. So there's a lot of, I think, courage with him and a lot of humility.
But there are some somewhat hoary old legends about him. I mean, the one that he stood on a hilltop in Ireland and banished all the snakes. That's not true, is it?
No, so many of these things are more legendary, or they come up in later writings about him. You know, he is a man of the 5th century, and so there's been lots and lots of centuries to write about him and all kinds of legends that are created about him. But from him, we have really two distinct letters that as the basis that history works with in writing the life of Patrick.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about the connection between St. Patrick and the shamrock, which of course is now, you know, synonymous with St. Patrick's Day.
Right. In explaining the Trinity, how are there three persons and one God? He sees the shamrock as a perfect example, the three-leaf clover. These three are all part of one piece of vegetation, I guess, or one plant, and yet they're united. So that distinction and unity in the shamrock, and it's held up by him as a teaching tool among the people there. And that continues, and the shamrock is the great symbol of Patrick and Irish faith in many ways.
Okay, now, why has the celebration of St. Patrick's Day become such a global phenomenon? I mean, no other saint that I can think of, there's such a razzmatazz on his feast day.
Yes, well, I'm from Chicago, and it's legendary there. They dye the river green, but it also is a religious holiday. We do start the day. We have a beautiful church right in downtown Chicago, Old St. Patrick's. The cardinal says the mass, and then that leads into a big breakfast, and then there's a big parade through the city. We also have a South Side parade, which where many of the Irish live. But Chicago would be an example, I think, of the Irish diaspora, where their Irish are really all over the world, and wherever they've gone, they've also taken their faith and their culture with them. Patrick is the day and the man that is celebrated. So I think the spread of the Irish brings the spread of St. Patrick, and there's a sense of gregariousness or fun or enjoyment among the Irish people. At the same time, it has, you know, very profound religious foundations, Holy Day of Obligation for many years, and it was a national holiday so that people could kind of spend the day in prayer. Now it's changed and it's become more of a celebration of Irish festival and culture, but I think you're seeing a pushback on that. I came across a priest last year who just said the church has to take back St. Patrick's Day.
It's become too secular, it's become too much of an opportunity to booze, and there's not enough piety.
Yeah, it's become kind of like a green New Year's Eve in many places, and that's just not really, it's not St. Patrick at all. The more you study St. Patrick, the more you're probably inclined to spend the day in prayer and fasting and penance, and he's really a great saint for Lent, and yet in the middle of Lent, it's sort of the day off for St. Patrick. So there's a lot of different conflicting levels. Great to celebrate a saint, great to celebrate our culture, but I think we have to do it appropriately.
You talked earlier there about how Chicago dyes the river green on St. Patrick's Day.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about how that tradition came about and how do they actually turn the river green and how long-lasting is it?
It lasts for a good chunk of just the day. Chicago has this funny river flowing right through the downtown, kind of with the skyscrapers lining it, and they dump 40 pounds of green vegetable dye, so it's environmentally friendly, and it turns it into a very pleasant green. It doesn't sound like that lovely, but it actually is kind of shimmering and very pretty for the day. It started with, I think, sort of testing on sewage water, you know, 50, 60 years ago.
And so almost by accident.
Yeah, by accident, and then it became, oh, this could be... So Chicago is always up for a party, and they were always looking for ways to kind of celebrate and do things. But what happens now, though, a lot of the skyscrapers turn their lights green. You'll see, like, throughout the whole downtown, what would be normally white light becomes green light on a St. Patrick's night.
Oh, the wearing of the green, the wearing of the green, the wearing of the green.
As we were saying, St. Patrick's Day celebrations have spread where the diaspora is. Going back in history, I mean, the first St. Patrick's Day parades took place, I gather, in the 18th century. Tell us something about that and how they sort of got about and
right.
spread.
Not in Ireland, but in the United States with the Irish, who were as part of the original colonies and then part of the colonial military, But there was also a sense of a secondary status among the Irish for many reasons in the United States. And so it was a way of just gathering and joining together, remembering their feast day, St. Patrick, and then they marched through some of the East Coast cities.
But they were also, in fact, demonstrating, weren't they, against the discrimination and their treatment.
Yes, exactly. It was a way of standing up and claiming their ground and their human rights and their human dignity. And then out of this grew kind of fellowship societies, the Hibernian Society, the Friendly Friends of St. Patrick. And these groups then coalesce and start parades in all the major U.S. cities, New York, Boston, Chicago. Savannah, Georgia is also known for its famous St. Patrick's Day Parade, and that's in the Deep South, an area not known for its Catholicism, but this little pocket of Irish Catholicism is found down there.
Yeah, in fact, I read that now it's about more than 100 U.S. cities where these parades take place, so it really is it's nationwide.
Kind of taken off in a way that we kind of unexpected.
And I also gather that it's become much bigger in Ireland itself. I mean, maybe they've sort of seen, what they do in the U.S. and see that as a chance to perhaps make more fuss.
I think a lot of back and forth with Irish people from the United States to Ireland. There's a kind of flow of immigration and emigration back and forth. But at the same time, I think they also have turned it into almost like a week-long festival
of Irish
faith and culture. But I think that's where the issue is. Is it really just becoming kind of a cultural, secular festival, or is the church taking the lead here? And that's the question, I think. It's not just meant to be a drinking holiday or even just a secular holiday, but a religious holiday, a saint's feast day.
And when you were growing up in Chicago, of Irish descent, how important was the figure of St. Patrick to you? And did you actually take part in any of these St. Pat's parades yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we still had to go to school, but it was a Catholic school, and so it was celebrated throughout the day. And then as you got older, it was kind of a cool thing to maybe ditch school for the day and take the train downtown and go to the parade. But we had always kind of celebration. Irish step dancing is very popular in Chicago. And this is this whole week, all the Irish step dancing schools really portray themselves and are out there. And so we'd always have demonstrations of that at school. Our next door neighbor ran her own Irish dancing school. So we were always part of her world and her celebrations and parties. And then all the great restaurants and pubs are open and families gather and have a great time. So that's really important. We even have a Miss St. Patrick's Day crowned for the day in Chicago, a young woman of Irish descent. And so kind of all the secular things, but also spiritual things. And then attending Mass and studying the saint is always part of our childhood as well. But it was always a fun day, but my parents always try to mix fun and faith.
I was speaking there to Father Matthew Gamba, a Jesuit priest of Irish descent who comes from the city of Chicago. St. Patrick is traditionally associated with the colour green, and his feast day has been described as a joyous explosion of green. Irish priest Father Sean McDonough is a renowned environmentalist and author of several books on religion and ecology. He says his country's patron saint was green in another sense as well, because Patrick was a man who both loved and respected our natural world.
St. Patrick and the Celtic saints, the Celtic world, for example, was very, very focused on the natural world. In the pre-Celtic tradition, you had the sacred trees, you had the sacred wells. And when Patrick came in, instead of working against that, he basically Christianized them.
That was Irish priest and renowned environmentalist Father Sean McDonough. Father Chris Bowles is the superior of the Lauriston Jesuit community in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. He now offers us this Lenten reflection that takes as its inspiration the biblical passage from Genesis, where God breathed into man a breath of life. He ponders on how we can breathe out the life of God for others during this season.
In Lent, especially in the early days of Lent, we hear a lot about dust and ash. It's words and it's practical. We begin the season by getting marked with ashes on the forehead, and we hear words that remind us that we are dust. and that we're going to return to dust. A few days after that, one of the Sunday readings comes from the second creation story in the book of Genesis, where we hear of our being created out of the dust, out of the dust of the soil. So we'd be forgiven for thinking that the point of Lent is to remind ourselves of our nothingness, our lack of anything lasting, our impermanence. But that's only half the story. Maybe it's not even half the story. Maybe it's just a part of Lent. Because Lent has more point to it than that, for sure. In the same Genesis story, in the very next line, in fact, which we also hear on that Sunday, we read one of the most exciting things in the whole of the Bible. And here's the text, word for word. The Lord God fashioned man of dust from the soil. Then he breathed into his nostrils a breath of life. And thus, man became a living being. Imagine that if you can, having the very life of God breathed into us. Let your imagination go wild with that picture, God breathing life into us. He breathed life into our nostrils, a breath of life. It gives us such a vivid picture of how we each began. We began with the very breath of God in us. What amazing things we become capable of, therefore, if we only realize it. We breathed God in, and so we breathe God out, and our breath becomes God's breath on and for others. In Lent, then, we don't focus simply on being dust and ash, ready to return to that state just whenever the time comes. Not at all. Much more, we focus on how we can become the breath of God for others. Now, it's not for anyone to tell us how we do that, how we become the breath of God for others. There are as many ways to be the breath of God for others as there are people listening to this reflection. For some, is going to be to do the things we've always done, but maybe to do them better, do them with more focus, with more compassion, with more intensity, with more love. For others, it might be to do things that have never been done before, maybe taking a risk, reaching out, making an offer of friendship perhaps, or speaking a word of forgiveness that has to be spoken. If we can imagine God breathing a breath of life into our nostrils, how do we imagine that we breathe a breath of life into the nostrils of another? And surely that's a worthy thing to ponder in Lent. But maybe it shouldn't just be something to ponder, like a meditation or a contemplation. We've got to make that real. It's got to be something practical, something actual, something meaningful. God did breathe into our nostrils a breath of life. And so how, in these days of Lent, will we breathe out the life of God?
That was Father Chris Bowles, Jesuit priest from the Lauriston community in Edinburgh. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.